Hello, and welcome to the MIT Press podcast. In this episode, the writer Kathy Unsworth will be in conversation with the artist and author Jenny Hvall. Jenny Hvall is a Norwegian singer-songwriter, record producer, musician, and novelist who has released 7 albums, including Blood Bitch, Apocalypse Girl, and Innocence is Kinky. She's also the author of 2 novels, Paradise Rot and Girls Against God, which were both published by Verso Books in 2018 and 2020, respectively. She'll be talking to Kathy Unsworth, who is the author of 6 novels and the co-author of Defying Gravity, The Life and Times of Punk Icon Jordan. She's also worked as a journalist and contributed to many publications, including 14 Times, The Guardian, and Mojo. Her book Bad Penny Blues is a piece of true crime fiction that follows the murder of a group of women who perform sex work in 50s and 60s London, and that will be published in the coming weeks by Strange Tractor Press. In the following discussion, they discuss the interweaving of literature and music, the occult, and their shared subcultural affinities. So, with introductions out of the way, I'll pass over to Jenny and Kathy.
I've got a place that I thought we could start from, which was, I think we've got quite a few things in common, even though we've not met each other before. And Jenny, one of your reviewers described Girls Against God as being about the strength and solidarity of despised women. This is very much what Bad Penny Blues is about, and about what most of my work is about. So maybe we could start off with you giving our listeners a bit of a précis on what Girls Against God is about and what your thoughts on that very subject are.
So I do think that I wanted to, I mean, as a musician, I have spent a lot of time thinking about what an artistic network is and what a community is. And I think I realized at some point many years ago, I mean, I always knew this, but I started traveling with more women in my band. And that was not in itself, you know, it's always about the people. But there was something that those women contributed with, because they were also not musicians. They were 2 American visual artists, a filmmaker and a visual artist. And it was just so amazing to have, for me, to have an interpretation of what's going on during like a piece of music happening on stage, because they were sort of musicians who didn't play instruments on stage with me, doing maybe some visual stuff. Maybe they created some films that we were sort of showing or interacting with. They were doing a bit of performance. They were singing karaoke. And so I think that's probably where Girls Against God, at least the sort of idea of an underground network of non-males in sort of a subcultural, artistic / magical realm started, perhaps. It also started with like having a lot of discussions when recording an album about making film. So none of the starting points of this book are literary. And I think otherwise I wouldn't have been able to write, because I feel like such an outsider when I write. I also feel like because I started out as a musician here in Norway, I feel like when Paradise Rot, my first book, came out, and this is like 11 years ago, 12 years ago almost, I felt like I was just seen as a musician trying to do some writing, and wasn't really taken seriously. And that's how I feel when I write. So I need to focus on something that isn't literature, otherwise I won't write anything. But I think that when I can sort of see the stage as the page, or a book as a film script, like that, I sort of have to see that image in my head of something that is transformed or can be transformed to something else. So yeah, I do think that creates at least a possibility for me to create a voice that is more collective, or is more after a blasphemous community or an alternative community. And I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I mean, at least it's a starting point to discussing it. I'm very curious as to what you're writing about now.
Well, it's very much an alternative community of women who were very much despised by all the people who've written about them subsequently, apart from me, I think. It's a true crime case, and it was set, it happened in West London, where I live. But all the women, they were all sex workers, and they were, eight of these women were really brutally murdered, really horribly murdered, and left sort of in a state that showed the world, the killer's contempt for women in general, I think, with strangled with their own underwear and left naked in this quite bizarre pattern in and around the River Thames. And I found out about this case because somebody wrote a true crime account of it about 10 years ago. Somebody who had had access to the Metropolitan Police files, which were supposedly sealed and were supposedly not for public consumption. But he had obviously seen enough to be able to write in graphic detail what had happened to these women, these eight women. And I realised when I was writing it that they all lived and worked around where I've lived for the past 30 years. So the geography is really important. Although their bodies are left along the Thames, they all lived in nearly all of them, or they all certainly worked in Ladbroke Grove, which now is like, you see the film Notting Hill and you think, oh, it's this swish, lovely, cottagey place for middle-class people. But at the time this happened, it was at the time Absolute Beginners was written by Colin McInnes. And he has this, I'm going to just try and find this really fantastic. It was basically the biggest red light district in London. And to add to that, there was all the immigrants that had arrived from the West Indies were living in very ramshackle accommodation. The only landlord who would have them there was a Polish Jewish refugee from World War II, who was the only person who showed them any sort of compassion. Peter Ackman, who'd gone down in history as a villain, but I think was actually the least villainous of some of the landlords around there. And they're living in this strange, shifting, seedy world where there was a lot of pop artists lived there. And one of my characters was based on this pop artist, Pauline Beattie, who's another person who's been sort of lost to history and has only recently started to get recognised for the work she did. But she is a contemporary of Peter Blake and Derek Bisher and went to the Royal College at the same time. So you've got the pop artists living there. You've got people like Colin McInnes and Colin Wilson living there. It's a really shifty, shading mix. And I really felt these women, that expression really defined how the strength and solidarity of despised women. They did try and help each other, these women. They knew their community was under attack from a mysterious predator. And one of the hardest things to work out was how he got their trust and got them to go with him. So it's a whole mystery that I wanted to recreate. And yeah, and that's that, just that phrase and what you've said in your book about, you know, women being called witches, if you want to put them down, it all sort of resonated with me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, even if I don't write about, I mean, I feel like sometimes my book doesn't even have people in, or the collect, like there is a singular voice or a singular character who's the protagonist, but there is also sort of underlying, I guess I want to call it community, choir or something of maybe witches, maybe outcasts, maybe because when witches are described, it's interesting to see how closely related descriptions of women historically sort of cross paths. It's not far from prostitution to witchcraft. I mean, it's the descriptions are so fictional anyway because it's they're describing themselves, or the gaze is describing itself rather than anyone else. You're describing your own drive. You're describing society's guilt or whatever. Describing religion, describing society, and you put the blame on the female body. That sort of seems to fit at the time.
The people in society who have the least say get vilified the most, basically. Yeah. Yeah, and this is something that, you know, I have explored through all my novels, and it seems to be something that you explore in your work as well, is, you know, how women who are at the bottom of the heap, financially, socially, how they can make their way and get out of their assigned roles or where they should, a society would like them to stay, how they can rise above. And often it is the case that it's through either artistic endeavour or it's through some kind of association with witchcraft, spiritualism, the other side, shall we say. This is how they, you know, how they make their way, by having, I guess, knowledge and talents that are sought after and that they can use to rise above. And is that something that you think you've been able to do through your music and your writing?
I think that was definitely a motivation. And I felt like that I could find a place at least that I wanted to belong to through artistic endeavors, through attempts, through like infiltrating networks that were not so hierarchic or placed differently in the hierarchy of that is society, even the art world. I mean, I've never been, I've many times had to sort of wonder about how much of a recluse I am, even within the arts community, because I think I'm always wanting to sort of stay an outsider in a way, rather than I'm never comfortable with people with power, even if they're the nicest people, even in the art industries. I'm always a bit scared. And I think it's not just being scared, it's also about skepticism towards all sort of forms of display of power, I guess. So for me, even when I didn't really know what was what, and I just started reading sort of, you know, randomly at the library, things that seemed part of a sort of separate canon or a non-canon or a canon that was more postmodern maybe, I was sort of looking for a different reality, different way of describing things, different language, and also different future. I mean, I guess that's a natural thing when you know that reality doesn't work and it's not real anyway. There must be other things to be drawn to and other timelines and other connections.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really interested in how much music plays that this spark of your inspiration came from your music, because when one of the things that really helped me to go back in time to the late 50s, early 60s was I looked up what was number one in the charts when each of these women had been murdered, and it gave me this really quite Catholic and really interesting timeline of music that was, you know, it goes from Roulette by Russ Conway, who was a legendary six-fingered pianist. He was very much involved in the sort of strange underworld of London clubs at the time, because he was secretly gay. And this is one of the big things about this whole book, is it's got a lot to do with the suppression of various sexualities and how the high highs rolled with the low lows because they had certain things in common, and these illicit clubs was where they met. So he's the first one, and that's quite amazing what I found out about him subsequently as well. And the next one is You'll Never Walk Alone, which Jerry Marston has just passed away. And that his theme song, but, and you think, oh, that's like a sentimental football terrorist song. But then you think, if a serial killer's walking behind you, you don't want to never walk alone. And so it goes on, Needles and Pins by The Searchers, which is quite a spooky little one. Can't Buy Me Love, which, by the Beatles, when it comes to sex workers. A World Without Love, again written by Paul McCartney, by Peter N. Gordon, which quite a sinister one by McCartney there. Please Lock Me Away and Don't Allow the Day to Come. Yeah, interesting. Then probably the most ominous one, The House of the Rising Sun by The Animals, followed by Baby Love by The Supremes. The last one, really sad, You've Lost That Loving Feeling, by the Righteous Brothers. So that sums up, doesn't it? That holds weird, to me anyway, the 60s before it began to swing, the end of the Cold War going into swinging London, and the sort of mix of Merseyside, Motown, piano, Russ Conway's like music hall, and the strange mix that was in the air in those times. And I also used the songs of Joe Meek, and I put him in the story.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, because He was living and working in this place at the time.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. It's interesting that some of these songs are quite, even if they seem like big hits, they're also quite mysterious. Because there was a You'll Never Walk Alone special on Norwegian radio, even that's how well known that is. And I listen to the radio all day because of the puppy, because it's always on so that she's used to sound. And I was just thinking about how, like, it is actually quite an intricate melody and harmonic track. And that sort of makes it much more sort of haunted with, obviously, with the lyrics, which I find really spooky. And also remind me of, like, childhood religion being taught about how Jesus is always following you and being super scared, because that's how I would react. But yeah, there's a lot of mysticism to a lot of those songs. I mean, to a lot of music that is very, very melodic, and a lot of music from that era is obviously, like, in the 60s, extremely melodic and sometimes quite advanced. It creates a real sort of mystery to an era, which I really sort of appreciate going back to, because there is a lot of suppression in that era too that you were talking about, and it kind of goes hand in hand. I mean, there's a lot of hidden energy in a harmonic change in a song. Everything means something. That's what I find. Now I'm going to sound like I'm 70 or 80 years old, depending on 70 or 80, one of those. But I find that is something that is lacking from a lot of music right now. There's so much music that nothing much is happening harmonically. And so I wonder, where is the repressed stuff? Where is it gone? Is it all in the production, or do we just pretend we live in an era without repression? And then, you know, we have these crazy people going into the Congress 2 days ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. All music does sound really manufactured to me at the moment. You know, not all music, obviously, but mainstream music. And one of the really sinister things about, you know, American radio used to be so brilliant, and there used to be all these little pockets of local radios playing local musicians, and that's how brilliant music, there was that boom in the 50s and 60s with people, you know, it was because they were listening without prejudice. They couldn't see what the person looked like. They just heard good music and went on that. I think that was the earlier part of the American century. But I read in a book recently that during the Bush era, all those local radios got taken over, and now there's just one central playlist playing the same boring music across the whole of that massive country. It makes you feel so depressed that manufactured music, and maybe that's partly why people are so angry, because they're not getting any proper musical nourishment anymore. They're not, you know, this music isn't telling part of their story like it used to be in the past. It's not come from the traditions of all the different types of people who came to America. They all brought different stories and songs and traditions with them. And
yeah, I mean, even if they had a bunch of radio and media, I mean, the society was so heavily censored, and who was able to be heard was also...
The radio gave them their freedom,
so, like,
yeah.
You know, it's so incredible. Like, it's hard to say that the past had greater diversity. I'm not sure if there was more diversity, but there were more chords. Maybe because people who had more education wrote them, which is cool about what's, you know, like present day, that the people, a wider sort of, like, it is in a way more representative what you can hear. It's just that it's also so commercialized that it's representing pretty much nothing most of the time.
Yeah, I know. And that's why I think you're very wise to be so wary of the music industry in general, because I think it is a really dangerous place.
I'm not even sure if it really exists at this point. It might just be some kind of evil magic. It's interesting to think about right now. I'm not sure, like, how this is with literature, because literature as an art discipline can still exist, whereas performing arts of all kinds and live music, I mean, they don't exist at all, which makes me think maybe they never existed, or maybe they definitely did not really exist as any kind of free expression in the years leading up to the pandemic, because of such an incredible, I don't know, like, direction of neo-liberal capitalist exploitation.
Yeah, it does. People have felt even greater need to tell stories. I mean, I've been a sort of strange beneficiary of this, because I've started I got some work before the pandemic started, doing online workshops with people, novel writing workshops. And since the lockdown, everyone, you know, what can you do? You sit at home, you want to tell a story. And these people are finally, who have been locked into this system of get up really early, have a long, grueling journey into work really hard, go home, you know, maybe have a few hours to eat and before you fall asleep, ready for the next day. Suddenly they're free from all of that. We've gone back to a sort of cottage industry in a way. So those people that were able to, got furloughed, use their time, they wanted to use it productively and they wanted to go back to storytelling. And there's you know, it's really interesting. I've been privileged to sort of see the response to the pandemic through all these people's writing and how they're sort of using it to sort out, you know, people have been doing these clearing up their houses, but they've been clearing up their memories as well, I think, and sorting all the things that have ever bothered them out into some sort of order. And what I personally love about writing is how it is a form of alchemy. So you turn all the bad shit that's ever happened to yourself or to other people who you feel really affected by into some kind of, if it's not gold, at least it's turned it into something else. And those things worry you a lot less after you. I don't know if you feel this way when you come to the end of a book, you think, oh, that baby's born now and it can go out into the world and live on its own and sort of haunt me no longer.
I don't think I've written enough. I don't even think I remember how I feel.
Well, Tom, can you tell me a bit about why you put Munch and his Munch and the black metal references in? Because that's a really interesting part of Norwegian history, the berserkery that happened there with all those.
Well, I think it was always there. So I felt like it's always been partly connected. I think there has been like a very concrete inspiration, especially with the face paint and some of the imagery, and also just the fact that he is the most famous visual artist to have come out of Norway. So black metal was started mainly by very, very young people who then probably had been to school and learnt about pretty much nothing else than Munch when it comes to art. And so did I. He's just one of those almost religious figures that exist in the Norwegian imagery, Norwegian subconscious, conscious. But one day I remember I saw I was doing some kind of research already before I started writing. I was doing some black metal research because I came a little too late to black metal, so I'd never really listened to much of it. At the time I was probably at least 5 to 10 years younger than the people involved in the scene. So I never really got to hear a lot of the famous recordings until much, much later. And I was doing some research and then I found this very quite famous press photo of Mayhem, which to me was like instant connection to a Munch painting because it was so similar. And it was very creepy. And I remember I made this collage, and for a long time it was the front page of my book in my own document, just a sort of a reminder of how closely connected black metal is to Edvard Munch. Maybe they even wanted to be him. Like, let's create music that could be this, because it's also extremely motivated by sort of inexplicable emotional response and the need to just be really ugly, really do something really ugly, really not out of the ordinary, but like otherworldly ugly, repulsive, you know, like opposite of what is considered good art or proper behavior, which is, you know, kind of quite a common trait to subcultural existence, I guess, or expression. Unfortunately, no parents know this. I mean, there should be some kind of parental education where you just learn that, oh, your kid is doing crazy stuff with pig's blood. Oh, you know, it's a common trait to any youth's exploration of subcultural. Let him do that instead of marching into the Congress 10 years later wearing stupid costume, scavenging the internet. So yeah, the monk connection, I think for me, it's just very obvious. And also probably to the black metal scene, like a lot of them, it would be very obvious just because he's such a pillar of Norwegian art, I guess. I mean, now we have the new Munch Museum, which seems to never open because of the building never being finished and also pandemic. But it's literally like leaning over the city because it's built in this...
spooky, haunting.
So it's like haunting the city. Wow. There is nothing else. This is the biggest. It's leaning.
That's amazing.
So if you're doing art, he's over your shoulder, you know, you'll never walk alone.
Wow. Wow. And how much do you think of the, that sort of black and white, the corpse paint, is to do with it being a world that is half the year in light and half the year in dark? Do you think that
it does seem like maybe it has more to do with life and death and how you're always part dead when you're alive and the other way around, the dead in the living and the living in the dead. But I think that when, I mean, my experience with half the year being very bright is that it's full of color.
Mm.
And then it's kind of gray or white in winter.
Mm.
So it's black and white is winter to me, and color is the summer. So I'm not sure, but I mean, it sounds good.
No, because I see, yeah, you've got Munch in the black metal band and I've got Joe Meek in his weird... Well, this sort of leaps back a bit to what you were saying about how some music from the 60s sounds really advanced, because when the first Jack the Stripper... The reason he's in my book is the night the first Jack the Stripper victim, Elizabeth Thigg, she was last seen in Holland Park outside the tube station. Across the road from there is this big recording studio where... And it started off as an artist studio in Victorian times. And then it was taken over in the 50s by this guy called Dennis Preston, who had a jazz label. And one of his engineers was Joe Meek. And Joe produced the single Bad Penny Blues in that building for Humphrey Littleton and gave him a top 10 hit with this song that I think that at the time Humphrey didn't like it because he was trad and he wanted to sound like Louis Armstrong.
Mm.
But Joe put the drums right to the fore. So it's got this really fun... Paul McCartney definitely heard it because Lady Madonna is the same tune virtually as this, as Bad Penny Blues. And anyway, but while he was working in there, he was stealing bits of downtime in the studio to make this album called I Hear a New World, which I don't know if you've ever heard this record.
You mean the Joe Meek?
Yeah, the Joe Meek record, yeah. Do you know it?
I have heard it, but I'm not sure if I remember which...
It's hit this really spooky electronica, Joe, and it's got like all these weird voices of Martians, and because he was quite obsessed with the space race, which was really a big thing.
Yeah. I have heard it.
The idea that he was making these really weird sounds, and in my head, this opened a portal, and through it came this Jack the Stripper, this evil force. And so when I wrote the first chapter, I was listening to Joe and sort of soundtracking the footsteps of the woman doing her last walk to her last ride to those sounds. So, yeah, so like you, all the stuff that I've written has sort of started off being music in a way, even though I'm not a musician myself.
What I find really interesting about Joe Meek as a reference is that the so much of his sound sounds like science fiction, or it's... processed, or it's looped, or it comes from a tape machine. So it's kind of otherworldly. It's like not of this world.
Yeah.
It's kind of, to me, it's instantly a safe place or a place that full of hope in a way, because it's beyond or somewhere else. Taking sound somewhere else, like definitely not wanting to sound analog, or not analog is the wrong word, but definitely not wanting to sound like just sound on an acoustic instrument that has this ability to sort of jump into space.
Yeah, like Telstar, it still sounds brilliant, doesn't it? It still sounds like he is beaming it off the satellite. And what I find really interesting as well is sometimes if you have a random shuffle, a Joe song will come on and I think, is it Joe or is it Pink Floyd? Sometimes it's really difficult to tell the difference. That's how far ahead of his time you are. And I think sort of, yeah, Joe, and that's the reason I got to go to Norway, was because my friend Pete Woodhead, who was a proper musician, me and him did a soundtrack that I could do readings from this book to. And I met this fantastic, you might know him actually, Leif Eckler, who works at NRK. He is a radio journalist. He was in London at the time when I was doing this, and he was a fan of Derek Raymond. He was one of my crime writing heroes. And I took him to some of Derek Raymond's hangouts in Soho, and he came to see me do this thing with Pete, having supplied in a very Joe Meek style. We did all the little Foley sounds together, like I put on high heel shoes and how it sounds to walk down the road. And then we wanted that David Lynch lighter effect. So we made all these little Foley sounds, and then he made this quite sort of meeky, jazzy soundtrack for me to eat to. And Leif got us over to Oslo, and he started a thing on an NRK for other people to do this. So it was really brilliant. So thanks to Joe and Bad Penny Blues, I got to see your beautiful world, Jenny. And that's why, sorry if I'm repeating myself, but I just love these links between, like you said, the living and the dead, the music and the literature and other arts. And you worked with that brilliant filmmaker, Zoe Anger. I looked at that fantastic film you've made with her, with her mother in it as well. How inspiring was that?
Well, that was really great. I mean, I was not with her at any point, but it was, I mean, I've worked with Zia for a long time, and we seem to have a connection where we just keep doing things that are intertwined, even if we don't know about it. It's just really wonderful to have this kind of friendship, this connection, and also this ability to, I just find it like such a huge gift to have someone to send music to, and then she'll have ideas that I never thought of, but are also like really connected to what I do. It's such a way, I mean, if only it would be, you know, it's like, it's a huge deal for me just to see how much value she can pull out of my work. And that in itself is so amazing to be seen in that way. And I think that's one of the most rewarding and maybe interesting parts of collaboration, the fact that you can create value, or like that you can value someone else's work and then sort of bring out common ideas, because that makes something really worthwhile. I mean, I generally think that music videos are not worth making because it's such an old format. I always think that it's not, why do we need them at this time? I don't understand why people still make music videos, but I love working with her. So, and I think that she manages to see things that are much more clever than I could in my music. And then I can have my work sort of come along with her work, which is really amazing. So I remember we were discussing it while I was on tour, back when we were on tour, you know, like when people could travel.
In the good old world.
Yeah, and she wanted me constantly to film stuff while traveling. And so it became this really fun collaboration. And I don't think any of it really ended up in the music video, but it was still such a rewarding process. And I think that it's always the conversation that's the most important part, because that keeps sort of things keep developing, and you're not, it's easier to just keep pushing what things actually mean. I mean, I like to work from the inside out, like writing a bunch of stuff, writing lots of lyrics, and I don't know why I write them or what they are about. And then I'm always asked what things mean and why I wanted to say this or that. And it's very difficult to answer because I didn't want to say anything. You know, I think it's like that probably for a lot of people who want to tell stories, that they don't have like, oh, I have this story and I want to tell it. But it has to sort of change you. Like, you have to be changed by writing. And so if anything, that's what you want. You want to be changed and change some part of your world or the world or these big things by uttering something.
Yeah, it's a constant process of learning new things, isn't it? And reaching and hearing new voices as well. I mean, some of what I write, I don't feel that I wrote it. It just came through me. You know, I was a handy receptor, shall we say. And I know a lot of people feel that way about writing fiction. Sometimes a character will come through like it was a seance and they will just take over. But they'll be a very important person in the book. So when you create music, it must kind of feel like other forces are coming through you. And I imagine it's the same for when a really brilliant bit of music comes through to a really good bit of writing. You don't really realize you've done it. It just comes through.
There was never any work done. It was just this, seance. Even though that sounds so, those words sound really big and it sounds like you want to talk about yourself as a genius, but I think the seance itself is not actually that mysterious. It's just another way of saying that you sort of let yourself be a blank canvas and things were happening in the room. Could be very simple and not very genius at all. If anything, allowing a more collective energy to flow through in words. Sometimes I feel that way about one line, you know, or one like chord change or one word. And that sometimes for me is enough to justify the rest of a track that maybe isn't well composed from all the way through, but has a moment of change.
Yeah, that's so true. And that's why that accident video was so brilliant, because I didn't feel like it was a music video to promote a track. I felt like it was a movie to go with what you put into that. It was like a little beautifully crafted mini movie of what was behind the expression in that song.
Yeah, and I think it was, which is why it was nice to have it as a music video after all, because it's such a, for me, it's like an emotional release to watch it. I'm not sure how it's like, what it's like for the rest of the universe, but not that they've seen it, but it's sort of this moment of clarity or seeing a bunch of situations come together and mean something, like, you know, with Zia using one of her mothers in the film. And having this element of mime, which I think works.
She's so brilliant.
Well. She's a proper mime artist.
She's got an amazing face as well. You just want to just keep looking at her. And the settings were brilliant.
Yeah, it's also brilliant that Zia's very good at expanding on the sort of humorous aspects of my work, which I remember early on when I was only doing, playing for Norwegian audiences and releasing my work in my own country. The humorous aspect would be completely overlooked. And I think that happens a lot when people are afraid of someone's voice. Not to make myself so important, but it's a very general thing. Humor is overlooked and seen as wanting to seem important or being too serious.
Yeah,
or crazy other. So it's really interesting how Zia manages to pair my work with something that is very much like a living canvas, very much almost, I would almost call it sometimes slapstick.
Yeah.
And at the same time satirical, but like just this really wide canvas of human expression, which I think the mime aspect and her mum brings in.
Mm, yeah. I know it gets a really good point about humour, because you can't approach this dark material without having a certain graveyard humour to. And actually, you can't even survive life without having a certain graveyard humour, I don't think. No. It's our weapon against the world, basically, isn't it? And, and it's not something that gets picked up. I know one of my favourite authors, Hilary Mantel, and her, finally, she gets the recognition she is due with the Wolf Hall trilogy. But no one's actually said those books are hilariously funny all the way through, as well as being profound, brilliant works of magicking us through a Holbein painting into Henry VIII's world. They're absolutely hilarious. I think there is a common thread of this to our work as well, at least I hope there is. Well, can I also say one of my other favourite quotes about your work?
Sure.
Actually came from somebody I used to work with, an old friend, Sharon O'Connell, who I used to work on Melody Maker with. And she said in The Guardian that what really stood out for her was that your words shock, not because they're about sex and desire, but because they're about vulnerability and longing. And I thought that was a really good point she made. Do you think that is a valid?
Of course, yeah. I remember even going back to my work many times, like different things, but maybe more than anything, my first novel, Paradise Rot, and I did not remember that it had much sexual, sensual content at all. I just remembered it being very sort of driven and about longing and, if not vulnerability, maybe more like dissolution, complete decomposition, but also then obviously vulnerability, because what is more vulnerable than something that is decomposing? Yeah, so I many times sort of forget that on the surface level, things get much more seemingly sexual or seemingly like, I don't know which words to use, but the provocative, all these things. And then I find myself when I am writing, just wanting to create links and different types of linkages between people, objects, gazes, perspectives, parts of hierarchies, just basically wanting to create more like webs of belonging and common ideas and sort of getting together and feeling communal energy. And I guess the words, maybe some of the words I'm looking for when I write don't exist or don't exist yet. So you're stuck with something that will be interpreted as a more, being more about sexual desire.
Yes, well, we can make up our new words. I mean, Shakespeare did quite a bit of that, didn't he?
But now they're just Shakespearean words.
But he did make words up that weren't there. So I think we just carry on. I try and put a new word into all my books that no one said before, see if it catches on. Just because I like playing around with words so much, actually. But no. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was, at the moment, I've been reading this amazing book by Stacey Schiff about the Salem witch trials, what actually happened. It is brilliant. This seems so appropriate. The witches, Salem, 1692, a history. It's the witches, Salem, 1692. And just, you know, events of recent days, this madness is bubbling to the surface. And it sort of brings me back to the witches in your novel. And how I've written about witches in mine as well, not this one, but others. But I really wanted to ask you, what was your first discovery of witches? How did you come upon the concept of witches and what they were in the first place?
I don't think I remember, but maybe reading mythology in childhood and reading about mythological characters that were witches, probably. And then a lot of bad TV series. And then being a goth, learning a lot in the early online days about Wicca. So in my sort of late teens, I was quite interested. But I couldn't get it to match my interest in modern / postmodern literature because it seemed like it was dirty and sort of unrefined compared to what I should be reading and what I should be doing. So I strayed from the path. I was interested, but decided to stick with the cool canon of whatever it was, reading Beckett or whatever. Joyce. I don't know.
No, it just makes me wonder, because I was a massive goth as well. But when I was really little, my mum used to take me to see all the Disney films, and she pointed out that all the queens, the evil queens, Maleficent and they were the beautiful, clever ones. And you wouldn't want to be stupid, you know, bumbling Snow White when you could be Queen Maleficent with a raven on your arm. And, you know, I mean, and so it always seemed really interesting to me that even though we're, you know, Disney is this sugary, sweet world, the best characters were the evil women, the witches. And then I also just remember my favourite book when I was little was called The Wickedest Witch in the World by Beverly Nichols, and about a witch who just lived in a suburban house, and she looked like she was about 20, but in fact, she was hundreds of years old. But she put her makeup on so well that she's always been an inspiration to me, Miss Smith.
I mean, there's lots of fairy tales, which Disney comes from and purifies.
Well, Maleficent, she seems quite a Norwegian witch to me, Queen Maleficent, with her raven.
Maybe so. No, I actually can't remember like the very first encounter I had. And it was probably quite negative, I would think, for a long time, until the more sort of... It's nice how internet brought a lot of different things together. For me, because I remember at the same time as I was reading about pagan theories, Wicca stuff, I was also starting to illegally download music, which also was like quite witchy to me.
Yes, a strange brew.
Hearing B-sides of artists I really loved and seeing and downloading videos as well, music videos, and all that seemed like witchcraft to me. So, and that appears also, I guess, in my book, this idea of the internet as witchcraft, or at least, I mean, definitely not now, but potential is there. So I got a bit obsessed when I was writing with creating the different, the other internet that was flesh-based, which I still think could be a pretty good movie, but maybe from 1990-something and not now.
Well, I have to say you've got many, many magical ingredients going on in your pot, Jenny, and long may you prevail. Yeah. No, and this has been brilliant because I now feel like I've been in a room with you both and we've just been having a really good, warm chat. Thank you.
Thank you.
And it's lovely to meet you both.
Yeah, likewise.
Thank you for listening to the MIT Press podcast, and thank you to Jenny and Kathy for taking the time out to have that wonderful discussion. If you don't want to miss out on the content we produce on the podcast, which features artists, scientists, writers, academics in discussion, make sure to hit subscribe on your medium of choice. Also, thank you to Samantha Doyle, who mixes and edits the podcast, and Kristen Galineau, who produced the soundtrack.